Welcome to episode 5 of the Cycling Europe podcast. These are the sounds of the Tour de France. But alas, I'm not in France. I'm still here in Yorkshire, but I have discovered the recently released online BBC sound effects library. Out of 16,000 sounds, only 44 are of bicycles, which doesn't seem very many, but there you go. Let's change continent. Here's bicycle passers with bell ringing in a side street in Alexandria, Egypt. You could almost be there. Let's come back home. Here's bicycle circa 1936 model passing through a puddle with some birdsong. You might hear some of those effects again in the future, but I probably won't tell you that they're actually sound effects. No need for any cheating in this episode of the podcast, however, as most of what you're about to hear was recorded on location. Later, I'll be reporting from parts of the National Cycle Network here in West Yorkshire. But first up, and this is a little bit different, is an extended interview with Tim Moss, one half of the couple behind the Cycle Touring Festival that takes place in Clitheroe this month. I met him and his wife Laura, you'll hear her very briefly at the start, in Saltaire near Bradford. Tim is about to publish a book he's written recounting his round-the-world cycle, and we chatted about the journey and the book whilst wandering around Roberts Park in Saltaire. All the sound effects are 100% authentic.
Very well, how are you?
Yeah, good, thank you. I'm not
here
to speak, I was
going
to go shopping.
Well, I thought you might go to the cafe down there, you know.
The Half Moon Cafe?
Yeah.
Yeah, I do.
I presume it's open, so.
Try
so,
it, yeah.
Are you happy going down there?
Yeah. I'm Tim Moss. I run an adventure website called The Next Challenge, where I document trips that I go on. I offer an annual grant to other people to go on their own adventures, and I sell a few books too.
Okay, and you are one of the two people behind the Cycle Touring Festival?
That's right, my wife Laura is the main person. It was her idea and she runs the show, and I help her out with organising it every year.
The reason why I'm talking to you today is because back in, was it 2013, 2014, you cycled around the world. Can you just first of all talk about why did you do that? What was the motivation for doing that in the first place? And then a few bits and pieces about the trip itself?
Absolutely, yeah. So the first time that Laura, my now wife, and I met, we went for a drink. And as you do on first dates, you talk about dreams and plans. And I can't remember which one of us said it first, but one of us suggested that we'd like to do a big cycling trip one day, and the other one leapt on the opportunity, on the idea, and said, yeah, me too. So we jokingly said, oh, in 2012 we'll cycle to Australia. And we became a couple, we got together, we got married, and we weren't sure if the other one was joking about the idea, but the more and more we talked about it, the more serious we became, until it became a solid plan. We were going to do this big cycling trip, and it happened to be in 2012. The only catch was that around about the same time I started struggling with depression, and sometimes I couldn't leave the house. I got stressed going around a supermarket, would have panic attacks and used to hide behind the bed. So I kept telling myself, oh, it's not a problem, you know, once we get cycling everything will be all right, but it clearly wasn't going to be. So we cancelled our plans and postponed them, and whilst I got help. But a year later, got better, improved, got our bikes ready, and set off to cycle around the world.
So were you students at the time? Were you working? Did you throw in your jobs?
We were both working in London. Laura was and still is a lawyer, so for her it was a big decision to quit a perfectly good job, a very good job that she'd worked so hard for. I had been working at home, freelance, organising expeditions as part of my website, but when I was struggling with the depression, that's one of the causes of that, I think, was being at home on my own all the time. So I trained as a teacher and had just qualified. So although I had less of a career behind me that I was worried about leaving, it was still a big decision to have just started a training program and done well on it, and then say, actually, no, this is more important. I want to get on my bike.
You're not the first person I've spoken to who has had issues with depression and who subsequently has become a long-distance cyclist. Do you think that's part of the recovery?
It's possible, and it's certainly good that it happens that way around, rather than you go on a big cycling trip and then you get depressed afterwards, which I could imagine some people struggling with after having such a specific focus. I don't know. When I had the depression, I kept telling myself, well, it's because I'm not on this big cycling trip, it's because I'm not on a big adventure, and that's why I kept thinking, oh, as soon as we start cycling, it'll be okay. But I don't think it was. I think it was, there was more to it than that. And I'm sure, but by the time we got ready to start cycling, I was a changed person and much stronger for it. And I'm not sure whether cycling had a sort of a direct impact either way. We had a fantastic time, and no doubt about it, and I've not had the problem since. But there were times on the trip when I'd get little flashes of it. For example, we spent 3 months cycling through Turkey and Iran in winter, which were some of the best times of the trip. But it was really tough just being constantly cold and vigilant all the time. You couldn't stop for a wee or to eat for too long because your hands and feet would get cold, and then it would be dark at 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And after just months of that, I think the problem was that I usually thrive on challenge, and I like pushing myself and working hard and doing things that other people think would sound horrible. But after a few months of it, I was getting tired of it, but I didn't like to admit it, because I was like, no, I'm the guy that's supposed to like this stuff. So I sort of fought against it. So the message, I think, was that even on the big cycling trip, I sometimes had similar problems.
That's interesting. So what month did you set off? What month of the year?
We set off in August 2013, and that's partly because I was teaching at the time, so needed to finish the term, and then we had a friend's wedding, so we waited till we could go to that, and then the very next day we got on our bikes.
If you didn't have those restrictions, the wedding and the academic year, would you set off at a different time, do you think?
Possibly. We might have set off in spring. I think it seems to be quite a common time, because you get a nice European spring, and then you can get, I imagine you could probably get across Turkey in the summertime. Whereas for us, we had fantastic summer across Europe. We're just chasing blackberry season east all the way to Greece. But it did mean that we hit winter in Turkey and Iran, which was very, very cold and hard. And in many ways, it was all the better for it, because it was very memorable, and it meant even more extreme levels of hospitality, because we'd knock on a door every evening and say, is it okay to put our tent here? And they'd look at us in our jackets and the piles of snow around us and say, don't be crazy, come on inside. And in Turkey, for example, we were there for 7 weeks and we only used our tent 3 times, because every night people just said, don't be daft, come inside.
And I think we'll come back to talking about perhaps the people in a few minutes when we talk about the book. You went through Europe. I think you went down the Adriatic coast, then through Turkey, Iran. What direction did it go in then?
Well, we were aiming for Australia, was the original plan. That's where my brother lives. And we originally thought we would do as much of the trip overland as possible. It's a cycling trip. We're going to cycle every mile. The first hurdle, I think, came after Iran. To keep going east, you've got two options. You either go through Pakistan and into India, or you head north through Central Asia. Because Pakistan, we'd ruled out as too dangerous. We'd spoken to people who'd been through there recently. Another cyclist had been attacked in an incident where various police men were killed. So it was a no-go for us, which meant Central Asia. But that would have also meant even more months of winter. So we decided, actually, let's just get a boat to the UAE, to Dubai. And then we would get round Pakistan and back into India.
So you caught the boat where?
from the we got the boat from the south of Iran into the Emirates.
Okay.
Cycled across the Emirates into Oman, and then we thought we could get a boat to India, but you can't really. So we just flew into India, and we sort of broke a rule we thought we had when we set off about not getting on planes, but we realised that it was a cycling trip, but nothing tragic happens if you skip a bit on a bus or you get on a plane. In fact, it opens up a lot of opportunities and makes your life a lot easier, and you still have the same experiences.
So you arrived in India, crossed India, and then what countries did you go through in Southeast Asia?
Well, in Southeast Asia, we flew into Vietnam, went up into Cambodia, down through Thailand, and down the length of the Malaysian Peninsula. The only thing I should mention is that getting out of India is quite tricky, just politically. The borders are often closed and you can't get visas and such like. So we knew we had to fly. And because we'd heard such good things about South Korea when we stayed with a cyclist in India, on a complete whim, before we flew to Vietnam, we flew to South Korea, cycled the length of that, took a ferry to Japan, and then flew down to South Korea. So we had a little holiday within a holiday.
Yeah, that is a bit of a detour heading north to South Korea and
absolutely.
Japan. And then where did you arrive in Australia?
In Australia, we just cycled a very small section from Adelaide to Melbourne. Again, we had another decision. We originally thought we'd cycle all the way across the legendary Nullarbor, but timing-wise, we decided by this point we'd already been away for a year and we wanted to get home for Christmas, and the decision was effectively either the Nullarbor or the USA, and we decided the Nullarbor would be a small trip in itself, whereas going across America would mean that we could more easily say, look, we've cycled around the world, because it felt like we're coming back.
But before you got to America, you did do New Zealand?
Oh yeah, I'm jumping around a bit, aren't I? We did also do a very small bit of New Zealand. We had a friend we wanted to visit there, so we cycled across the North Island in about 2 weeks.
Then you did it across America and then back to Britain for Christmas of 2014?
Correct.
That sounds like cycling all the way around the world to me. You're about to publish a book about the trip around the world. What's the name of the book again?
The book's called With the Sun on Our Right, because in the Northern Hemisphere, heading east, the sun was indeed always on our right-hand side, and Laura has some photos of terrible tan marks to prove it.
It's now 2018. You've waited 4 years. Most people presumably would want to get things written down before they forgot them. Is there a reason for the four-year delay?
Yeah, there is a reason, and it's not that I've waited that long, it's been that I've been writing that long. I wrote a book a few years ago, very different topic, but at the time I was freelance working from home, so I could spend as long as I wanted on it. Now I work full-time in professional services, training as an accountant, so my time's very limited, especially with other projects like my website and the festival to organise. So it's been a real, it requires real discipline to find the hours. So what I've done is teamed up with a friend who's also writing a book and set ourselves goals each week. And my goal has been for the last 2 years, every week, to spend 4 hours on my lunch breaks at work, or sometimes in the evenings, working on the book. And then every Sunday we phone each other up and he says, how many hours have you done? And I say, how many hours have you done? And by doing that, 4 hours every week for 2 years, 6 hours a week in the last 6 months, and up to 10 hours a week when the deadlines loom, that's what's taken the time to get the finished product.
The books that I've written, I feel as though I've spent the last 8 years trying to persuade people that they're not books about cycling, they're books about travelling that just happens to be on a bike. And I think yours, similarly, is not really about the cycling, is it?
Yes, that's true. I've tried to put as little about bikes and cycling in as possible, pretty much, because I think, although I like cycling and I like bikes, often it's the least interesting part. And for us, by far the most interesting element of our trip was all of the people that we met, partly because of the message that left us with about humanity and the kindness and good spirits of people all over the world. And then partly because you get these glimpses into people's lives, their homes and who they are. And you meet some really interesting, fascinating people, and you can tell their stories, which are often more engaging than our own.
How many people feature in the book altogether?
Oh, I've not done a count, but exactly. I was, because I'm quite a nerd and I like my stats, I've got a little spreadsheet that keeps track of where we slept each night, how many miles we did, and whether we slept in a tent, in a hotel, or at somebody's house. And when I crunch the numbers, I think it's somewhere around 230 nights were spent on our own, like camping or in a hotel, and 231, just one more, was spent being hosted by other people. So more than 50% of our time away was with other people.
And how did you find them? Did you? I mean, I've used warm showers a lot. I don't think I've ever, or I've met friends or people who I've kind of had a previous connection with. I don't think I've ever rocked up in a town, bumped into somebody, and they said to me, "Oh, Andrew, come and stay with me overnight."
Well, we did use warm showers, and when that wasn't available, couch surfing. And warm showers is just phenomenal. It's just such a wonderful... It's just the fact that it exists is great, and the fact that the people who meet you are usually cyclists, they know you're going to want to have a shower and get some food in before you're going to feel human. That's wonderful. But we did have just as many nights with what we just call acts of kindness. Sometimes that would be us knocking on a door and holding up a letter we've had translated into the local language. It would never say, "Can we sleep in your house?" It just says, "We're a married couple, we've cycled however many thousand miles from the UK, we've got a tent, we've got everything we need, we just need somewhere safe to sleep and some water."
And how did people react to that? I can't imagine, imagine doing that in Britain, if you were, say, a French person or an Indian or an Australian. I think more often than not you'd be sent packing.
Well, that's what we thought. The first few times we used it, we felt nervous, worried we're just going to make people angry or be laughed at. But in a year and a half of using that letter in 20 different countries, sometimes people couldn't help, but not once did anyone react with anger or annoyance or anything other than, "Oh, I'd love to help you." Sometimes they wouldn't even bat an eyelid, they wouldn't even finish reading the letter, they just open the door and wave you in. And it is just worth noting that we often thought that about the UK, you'd never get that kind of hospitality. But we did a little sort of preparatory trip before we went away, and we cycled up towards Scotland, and we remember knocking on a door in somewhere in Cheshire, just asking to fill up water bottles. Laura went off while I held the bikes, and the door opened and I saw her disappear inside, and a few minutes later I saw her walking past the upstairs window, and I'm thinking, where do these people keep their tap? And it turned out they were about to go out for dinner, but they just left us in their unlocked open house and gave us a room for the night and food. So even in the UK it still happens.
Oh, it's good to hear. Can you talk about some of the people that are featured in the book, perhaps your most memorable people that you met?
Certainly, yeah. I think we've met some real interesting characters in Iran, sort of the home of competitive hospitality. People were literally shouting at us in the street to come and stay with them for tea. I remember one night we were up in the mountains in the middle of nowhere as snow was coming down. Our water had frozen in our bottles. And then to our complete surprise, we came across a great big building, this huge concrete thing, and knocked on the door, and it turned out to be headquarters of the Iranian Red Crescent, which is a little bit like our Red Cross. And they just welcomed us inside, and it was a sort of a rescue team. They had all these sorts of vehicles, like Thunderbird vehicles, that they would use to save people stuck in the mountains. And so we spent the evening with all these young men communicating using Google Translate on our phone and playing UK versus Iran ping pong in their basement, which was quite a surreal experience.
I've heard so many people say that the Iranians are so friendly and welcoming, and it's just completely at odds with what we hear in the media. It's a real shame that we've kind of got that common misconception. or rather that we impose that common misconception upon individuals simply because of what the actions of their government are.
Yeah, and time again, people would say, because they know what their reputation is internationally, they'd say, what did you think of Iran before you came here? Then after they'd wined and dined and looked after us like nobody else, they'd say, what do you think of Iran now? And of course, we wouldn't just be being polite when we said, it's fantastic, you're so kind. And they'd always say, go home and tell your friends.
Can you think of one person in Iran that you wrote about in the book? A specific person?
Yeah, I remember there was the first night that we arrived in the country. We'd been told by so many friends that it's a lovely place, but we were still a bit nervous. We'd read about the nuclear weapons and the accusations of terrorism, so we were pretty nervous cycling through our streets. We'd arrived at the small hours of the morning, cycling through the streets of an empty town, and a car started following us, so we started taking turnings down side streets to avoid it, and it kept going behind us, and it eventually pulled up next to me, and I just gripped my handlebars thinking, what's going to happen here? And he just wound his window down and shouted, hello, welcome to my country, welcome to Iran, this is my wife, this is my son, come to our house for tea. And so from that moment on, we knew that it was going to be an okay place to be.
Did you find the Indians similarly welcoming?
We met lots of nice people in India, and we did the particularly memorable evening when we'd had a really rough time. We got sick quite a lot and get a lot of attention in India. The very different sort of social norms, and staring and fiddling with your bike and looking through your panniers is sort of just normal behaviour. It's not people being rude, it's just how they act. But when you're hot and you're sick, it can be really trying. And we couldn't find anywhere to sleep. The hotels were all trying to overcharge us, and they had rat poo on the beds, and they were all being very unkind. So we just cycled out of town into the desert, and we stumbled into this village where there was a man with a huge moustache, read our letter, scratched his chin and said, well, he didn't speak English, just waved, came along, and he met some other people with big moustaches and turbans, and they all scratched their chins and twiddled with their moustaches whilst we wilted in the heat. And eventually a woman came out, took one look at us and said, sit down, let me bring you some tea and some biscuits. And she found us a place to stay.
And the people who you, perhaps not the warm showers people, but the people that you stayed with, who you met in those kind of conditions, did they ever expect anything in return from you?
Did they ever expect it? I certainly remember a few times trying to offer money for the food we'd receive, and places, particularly like in rural Turkey, where they were obviously very poor, but there was no one would even consider taking that. We stopped buying food for ourselves in Turkey because it kept going rotten in our panniers because everyone fed us, and instead just bought boxes of chocolates and things we thought that people might accept. You know, they wouldn't accept money, but if we forced a box of chocolates or a packet of biscuits into their hands, then they would take that as a small token of thanks. But no one ever asked for anything else. The closest you would get would be with warm showers people, where there's a bit of a quid pro quo that you share your stories and hear theirs. But that's we got the best end of the bargain.
Do you think people in Europe, there is a little more expectation that there should be something in return, whether it be a bottle of wine, whether it be a drink down the pub or local bar, something like that?
I could perhaps see that more with something like warm showers, where it's arranged in advance and you know it's going to happen, and it's just sort of polite, isn't it, to take something with you. But I can't think of anywhere. I mean, it could be that I've just cycled around the world and offended hundreds of people, but I can't think of anywhere where that was made apparent that, you know, I'm giving you a bed for the night, you owe me something now. I never got that impression.
You've already mentioned the fact that things like you're using Google Translate, you had a letter translated into the local language. Travelling around Europe, I think we're quite fortunate because lots of people do speak English, and then hopefully lots of other people speak some other European languages, and obviously it's the same script. But the challenges multiply once you leave Europe. You've got different scripts, you've got different cultural norms to abide to. I can imagine it just triples, quadruples the challenge of being able to do what you were able to do.
Yeah, I think there are sort of two elements to that. I think on the one hand, you've got these, you can plan, and you've got technology now that really helps. Google Translate, you can hold up your phone to a sign written in Hindi or in Japanese characters, and it'll translate it on your screen into English. So you can use that sort of thing. But on the flip side, most of the time when you're cycling, you're not trying to convey complicated messages. You're saying, is this water safe? Can I put my tent here? Where can I buy food? And as long as you're not too proud and you don't mind doing some daft charades, it's anywhere in the world can understand, I'm hungry, can I sleep here? So we'd usually get away with that. And people, once they realise the sort of the vulnerability of having a someone in foreign lands who's looking for help, they'll help you out at the drop of a hat.
That's such an interesting point about the fact that because cycling is intrinsically a simple activity, and travelling on a bike over multiple days is, if you're camping especially, fundamentally such a simple concept, it actually doesn't require much translation to get across what you're trying to do.
No, not at all, and that's part of the beauty of it.
You also went to South Korea and Japan, and again, very, very different countries culturally. How did you find cycling through those and the people that you met there?
Well, very interesting. We went from India, where we got lots of attention, it was busy and hustle and bustle, to South Korea, which has one of the best cycle network infrastructures in the world, by the way. So to have this ultra-modern, pristine, very easy to travel through place. The catch with South Korea, although it was very welcome at the time, is that because we were following a cycle path along a river, we didn't meet as many local people, whereas in Japan we were just making our own way again, as we did most of the time. So we did meet all sorts of various people, and I think before we went there we thought, like the UK, people in Japan, oh, they're very reserved, aren't they? We won't expect the same sort of hospitality as Turkey and Iran. But we should have known humanity better by that point, because I remember cycling through a rainstorm, getting absolutely soaked through, and a man flagged us down at the side of the road and started asking questions in broken English. I'm thinking, mate, this isn't the time. I'm freezing cold. Why are you talking to me? And eventually said, where you sleep tonight? And we said, well, I don't know, probably side of the road somewhere. He's like, you sleep my house. Jumped in his car and then navigated us back to his house, threw us some towels to get in a hot shower, and then when we came out, he revealed that he was a chef and he was going to cook us some dinner. And if there's one person you want to be hosted by on a cycling trip, it's a professional chef. And we had similar experiences elsewhere, with someone else picked us up in a big bus when we couldn't make it to his house, took us home and gave us a tour of the town, and then another lady making us Wagyu steak in a house when we were going to camp in the garden. So really interesting there as well.
Yeah, I had a similar experience actually in Albania, now I think of it, where I arrived in this town at the end of this very long day, ended up staying in this motel. The restaurant had shut, but the guy who owned the hotel and the restaurant got on the phone to his son, who was working in a restaurant a few blocks away. The son cooked me up some food, had it kind of ferried across by somebody on a motorbike just to feed me. I felt very guilty, but it was a good meal. After all those different countries where culturally they're very different, linguistically they're very different, to then go back into an Anglo-Saxon world of Australia, New Zealand and America.
It was sort of mixed emotions. I mean, there was definitely some relief after, you know, we speak English in the UK, but since then we'd not been in any English speaking places. We had all these different scripts I'd never even knew existed, like Georgian and Armenian with their own characters, to suddenly, after a year of that, to be able to speak English and get directions in detail was great. But yeah, a little sadness that we were losing the sort of exotic, more unfamiliar places. But as it happens, when we spent the last 2.5 months cycling across the south of the United States, it was one of the most interesting parts of our trip. Firstly, we were following the Mexican border, which we hear a lot about, whether it's through Trump's vision of it or alternatives, but we stayed with border guards and federal agents and a sheriff in Texas who lived right on the border. You could see the border from their house and you could hear about how they catch people and who's coming across and the problems there are and whether it's how you might solve them and that sort of thing. And further along, we cycled through Louisiana and New Orleans with people who'd lived through Hurricane Katrina and Rita, whose houses had been smashed to smithereens and whose livelihoods and friends and family had disappeared, but they'd rebuilt, and by the virtue of the fact we were staying with them, they were still as warm and hospitable as ever, even if they had stories to tell.
Did you find America to be a threatening place?
If there was anywhere that we did feel occasionally threatened, it possibly was the US, and that was, I think, a combination of the drivers. There were more drivers there than anywhere else that clearly didn't like cyclists and would shout at you, rev their engines, do close flybys and things like that. And also the proliferation of guns, which is something I've explored a lot in the book, because it was really, really interesting to spend so much time with people who were into guns or had a gun out of necessity. I think we've got fairly fixed views about gun control and weapons in the UK, but it's easy to prejudge the people from other countries and their own views. But hearing about it from them firsthand and all of the different reasons, it was very interesting to sort of open my mind a little bit to sort of the reasons that people might have them. But in terms of the threats, we had those, the drivers and the proliferation of guns. But even then, we're talking about a tiny, tiny minority. We had such hospitality in the US, in every state we went to, so many friendly people. And because they're American, there's no reservedness there. People will happily come up to you and talk and invite you into their home. So, yeah, we had a lovely time there.
I mean, Mark Burman, when he went round the world for the first time, I remember on his documentary and also in his book, the only place he really had problems with crime was in America. And I think he also got knocked off his bike in America, didn't he? Which, you know, kind of ties in with what really you were saying about the drivers. So this book, it comes out imminently. When is it out?
Well, the official launch date is the festival, the Cycle Touring Festival, on the 1st May bank holiday. I'm taking pre-orders right now because I'll be self-publishing this book. My previous one was published, but this time round I've decided to do it myself. And if nothing else, by taking pre-orders, it gives me an idea of how many I should order. If it's just my mum and my auntie buying a copy, I can just order 10. If 100 people want to buy it, then pre-order it, then I'll order a few more.
And how have you found, because I think the previous book was it a fact-based book about expeditions and...
Yes, the first book was called How to Get to the North Pole, and each chapter was about doing a different type of expedition, like how to cycle around the world or how to cross a desert. So that was, some senses, it was very hard because every single sentence I wrote, I had to fact check. Is that really true? Do you have to go to the North Pole in the spring, or why don't people do it other times?
Whereas this one, you could just make it up.
Exactly. On the flip side, the other one was very structured. Every chapter had a what kit do you need, how much does it cost, and I could just fill in the blanks. Whereas here, we're starting with a blank canvas. What we've got, so a lifetime of stories, but which ones work on paper, which ones are interesting to other people, and which ones can you fit into the narrative. So, and doing that in these 1 hour lunch breaks, trying to get my head in gear when I've just come out of a meeting and try and write something that's engaging or funny or moving and thread it all together, that was the real challenge. It took best part of a year ago, I'd finished writing all the way from the UK to the east coast of the US, and I spent the last year editing, improving, trimming it down to make it better and not just having the stories in there, but make a proper narrative from it.
What did you base the writing on? Was it, did you write a journal at the time? Presumably photographs? Was it a bit of a detective job piecing it all back together?
Well, because when I started 3 years ago, so within a year of getting back, probably sooner than that, probably 6 months after getting back I started, we both kept journals, and the fact that there were two of us is really helpful, because if one of us can't remember, or even if we both can't remember, you can talk it through and between you piece it together. But between our journals, between the blogs that we wrote, between my nerdy spreadsheet that says where we were and who we stayed with every single night, and looking things up on Google Maps, there's nothing I've not been able to remember between Laura and I.
Was it more of a challenge writing this one or the fact-based one?
This one has been more of a challenge. It might not be the first word I'd use, but it certainly felt like a huge project. It's only starting to sink in now. All of those hours I had to squeeze in every week for the last 2 years, getting to the end of the week thinking I haven't done my hours yet, I've got to find some time, I can't go out for lunch, I can't sit with my friends, or I can't go and meet Laura in a cafe. I need to get these hours done, I need to write this book. So now, just with the final bits of proofreading for typos, it feels like, for at least personally, it feels like a real achievement to have got there.
Yeah, word of advice, get rid of the typos, because the reviewers are merciless. They will home in on the typos and then base an entire review on the fact that you've spelt dissent wrong 3 times in your book. But anyway, are you still in contact with any of the people who are mentioned in the book?
Well, yeah, we are in contact with a few, and it's not necessarily the most likely characters. There'll be some people you might have spent several nights with through warm showers who were very similar to you, and you've connected and you've got things in common and you've liaised about that. So other times it will be just someone who flagged you down at the side of the road and gave you a bag of tangerines, who you gave a business card to with your email address, and they just messaged me on Facebook out of the blue, and you think, is this spam? You're like, hold on, no, I recognise that face. And you suddenly realise that was the guy in Iran who gave you some food.
Have you got any concerns about them perhaps reading what you've written about them?
Yeah, that's a really interesting issue. The moment I've changed all of the names and the fact some of the locations and things will have changed, so everything that happened in the book is true. There's nothing made up, but it might be that a character's in a different country or a different part of a country, or I've merged a couple of stories together to make it a neater narrative. And yeah, it would be a concern. I hope I've been fair to anyone. There are no hatchet jobs, and we didn't meet many horrible, nasty people, so I hope I've done people justice. But equally, I'm sure someone else's version of what you think you're like is never going to be quite the same, so I hope no one will be upset by it, but it's certainly something I think about.
Are you going to be speaking about the book at the Cycle Touring Festival?
Yeah, I think Laura and I will do a joint talk. We feel a little bit uneasy about putting ourselves on our own bill for our own event, but equally I think people know us and will know about our trip, so I'm sure some of them will want to hear about it. And equally, the whole point of the weekend is people have done cycling trips and talking about it, so yeah, we'll be one amongst many interesting speakers, I hope.
You obviously run the website,
thenextchallenge.org,
okay, and there's video, there's pictures on there of your original trip in 2013-14?
Absolutely, yeah, so you can read all of the original blogs and see the photographs. We made little videos as we went, and we've just had a sort of professional video made from all of our clips that you can see. And then I'm writing about the process of the book, so the details of how I've set aside X hours each week to focus on a goal. I'll be writing next week about the reasons for why I'm self-publishing rather than using a publisher. And then I think I'll probably do something about the depression and the mental health issues, because I've never spoken about that on the blog before. I hadn't intended for the book to include that, but it was impossible not to start explaining how we got on the trip without going through that, because it was such a big part, and a horrible part, but it was a big part of our lives at the time. So I think talking a little bit about that, because I think some people will be interested. It's very easy to have a blog where you talk about all the good stuff and, oh, look at me on this great adventure, I live a great life, but reality is most of the time I'm sat in an office like everybody else, and also at the same time I have, like lots of other people, have had mental health problems and got past them.
When you've cycled around the world, what do you do next?
Well, I suppose the main thing to say is that although we use the phrase cycled around the world, it's an easy shortcut, because rather than say listing the exact countries we went through, but the truth is we only went through probably 10-15% of the world's countries. There are bits we skipped, there are continents we never even went to, so there are plenty more cycling trips that we could hatch. And don't ever think that going on a big trip like this will scratch the itch, because it won't take long for that itch to come back.
Okay, well, good luck with the book, and thank you.
Thank you.
The book, With the Sun on Our Right, is available from Tim's website, thenextchallenge.org. And if you listen to episode 6 of the podcast in June, I'll be reporting from this year's Cycle Touring Festival that Tim and Laura organise. Tickets for this year's festival have sold out, but I'm sure it will be back in 2019. That was Bicycle Bells' Several Ringing from the BBC Sound Archive, complete with crackles on the recording. More authentic Bicycle Bells now. In the second part of the podcast, I'm back outside, but this time on the bike. Over to me. It's Saturday the 14th of April 2018, and I think I may have just started my quest to cycle all the National Cycle Network routes in Yorkshire during the course of 2018. I'm not in Hull, and my route for today is not going to be Route 1 along the east coast to Whitby. It is, or currently rather, I am sitting on my bike looking over the valley that leads to Murfield. I've got a railway line to my left, there's another train. You can hear that perhaps. Below me is the canal. It's all very industrial, and I'm on a very wide bridge, presumably a viaduct, an old railway viaduct, I would imagine, across the canal that's going to take me to Murfield. I picked up Route 69 in the centre of Huddersfield, or rather Bracket 69. I'm perhaps thinking that the bracket indicated that it was full of refuse, because the first things I met along the off-road section were a discarded shopping trolley, a burnt-out sofa, loads of rubbish, and even a rat. I haven't seen a rat for a long time, but that was what welcomed me until I got to the rather nicer Bradley to Birkby Greenway, which was running parallel to the railway line, and that's the route that I've continued to follow. A couple of cyclists just passing me, and I'm going to keep following this all the way to Murfield. That should hopefully link me up with the Spen Valley Greenway. I'll go along that up to Bradford, I think it goes to. Whether I finish in Bradford, well, I suppose it depends on the time. It's now around 11 o'clock, so I'll see how far I get. But at least I've started. That's the main thing. I've just passed through Murfield. Stopped at a cafe, Italian-style cafe, next to a bike shop called Sobey Bikes. And I'm now back on a off-road section, somewhere near Murfield. I haven't seen a sign for the Greenway yet, for the Spen Valley Greenway, but hopefully I will do soon. Yeah. Hiya.
I thought there was a cafe down there, so we thought we'd go another mile and a half.
Well, there's a good cycling cafe up in Murfield.
On the Greenway?
Yeah, well, if you turn left onto the Calder Valley Greenway.
Well, that's where we've come from. We've come from Cleckheaton.
All right.
So there's one on there, on the Greenway there, but it's nearly back at the car. Anyway, it can be better now.
Well, I've arrived at the end of the Greenway. Or rather the Spen Valley Greenway, which for me really is going to be the start, because I'm going to turn round and now head in the direction of Bradford. The people I was just having a chat with there, they've come down the towpath of the Calder and Hebble Navigation, which is not a cycle path, and the little lad there was not recommending it, so I'm not going to go down there. But I am going to turn round and now head in the direction of Bradford along the entire length of the Spen Valley Greenway. When I get to Bradford, I'm not sure. Might continue, might stop there, get the train back, perhaps cycle back to Halifax. Is there another cycleway that goes from Bradford to Halifax? There probably is, actually. I'll probably look it up when I get there. Right, here we go. There is actually a cafe further up here.
There is, oh, yeah, well, that's the one we're aiming for.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, just before you go under a bridge, I seem to remember. See you later. It's shocking, really, the extent to which people are willing just to chuck their crap here, there and everywhere. I'm delighted to say things have improved. A lot less litter this end. I suppose when you get away from the housing estates, that's where it's worse. And we're now on classic Greenway territory, heading slightly uphill along a well tarmacked smooth path. Lots of people on the Greenway, lots of cyclists, dog walkers, a few runners, just people out appreciating this first day of what we could begin to call spring 2018. Long may it continue. Thank you. It's a little bit sad, I suppose, but inevitable, that we define our knowledge of the geography of where we live by the roads, and I can certainly tell where I am now simply because I've just cycled across a bridge over the M62, and towards my right I can hear and also see the M606, which is the motorway spur road that links the M62 with the centre of Bradford. But I wonder how many people on that M606 know that if they were to get on their bike, or even on 2 feet, they would have a far more pleasant journey, okay, a lot longer, but a far more pleasant journey if they cycled up this Greenway, which is very nice. Lots of old Victorian railway infrastructure, of course. Hi.
Hi.
And lots of other people to enjoy it with. And here's another little tunnel. I'll see you in Bradford. So that was the Spen Valley Greenway. It ended when it met the main railway line from Bradford to Halifax, I think, which is inevitable because it's a disused railway line and all railway lines must connect, I suppose. But it's a shame that it didn't continue a little bit. It went through an industrial estate and then back onto a shortcut through a park of some description. So it could have been continued a little bit. I suppose the advantage of giving these things names is that people remember them. People don't tend to remember National Route 66, although perhaps 66 they do, but they do remember the Spen Valley Greenway. So by giving it a name, it brings it into the consciousness of a lot more people. But anyway, I'm now paused on a hill in the middle of a park on the outskirts of Bradford, after having just re-emerged into the urban world and a wall of inevitable litter that was, again, next to a housing estate. But, hey, this park's nice, next to a pitch and putt. And in a few minutes, it's all downhill now into the centre of Bradford. I'll be in the city centre itself. And I've got the decision to make, should I continue? Because Route 66 does continue all the way to Leeds, or the outskirts of Leeds, I think, and then even further to the west. But I'll see how I feel I'll have a look at the map when I get into the centre of Bradford and make a decision. Those are the sounds of the centre of Bradford, which is a mixture of good sounds and bad sounds. The bad ones being the traffic behind me and the good ones being the kids playing in the fountains in front of me. I often think when I come to Bradford that people who come here for the first time will probably be surprised as to what they found. I think most people think of Bradford and they think northern industrial city, and they're right, it is a northern industrial city, but one which actually they've spent a lot of time and money on in the last 5-10 years, and it's a lot better than it used to be. They're really beginning to cherish its heyday, which was probably about 150 years ago in the 1860s and 1870s, when it was a very affluent place, lots of really beautiful Gothic architecture, and they've added to that with what I can see in front of me, which is the large centenary square. To my right is the Gothic town hall that they've recently spent some money on cleaning and tarting up, and then behind me is the Alhambra Theatre and the old Odeon cinema that they're trying to get the money together to reopen as a music venue. Looks as though that's going to go ahead finally. And then behind me, in a more modern building but not a bad building, is the Science and Media Museum, which is an offshoot of the Science Museum in London. Certainly compared to when I used to come here as a kid, if I was standing in the same place 30, 40 years ago, I would just see a big tower that was the National Provincial Building Society. That's all gone, and it's actually, dare I say, a nice European city centre. And a day like today, when wow, there's some blue sky up there. It's rather a nice place to be. Well, I've decided to continue, and inevitably I got kind of lost in the suburbs of Bradford. I think I saw one sign for the 66, but now, looking at the online map, I'm pretty sure I'm back on track. It looks as though, or I suspect, I'm going to be following the road for a lot of the way to Leeds, but you never know, I might discover another hidden off-road track, another greenway perhaps, you never know. I remain hopeful, but I'm about to join Canal Road, which is the busy road that takes you down to Saltaire eventually. So wish me luck. Well, this is turning out rather well. The route from Bradford towards Shipley was actually okay, although I did get lost once or twice, went back on myself. And now, and for the remainder of the journey to Leeds, it's just a matter of following the canal, the Airedale Canal. Okay, it's not brilliant in terms of its surface, it's a bit up and down, it's not made up, but hey, apart from the big puddles, because of all the rain we've had recently, it's perfectly cyclable, albeit perhaps not as quickly as more user-friendly canal towpaths. So I'm happy. Even the sun's come out, and dare I say it, it's actually quite warm. I'm now beginning to approach the centre of Leeds. Although it's still very green, I'm still just beside the canal. You can see the tower blocks of Leeds and general urban clutter is increasing. I suppose if I do continue to discover all these cycle routes in Yorkshire, then it's going to be a bit like today in terms of discovering new bits of a place that I thought I knew pretty well. But clearly, I don't. There is an alternative cycle path from Bradford to Leeds, and that's the cycling superhighway, and I would imagine that is a very, very different experience to what this has been. And as if to prove that I'm back in the urban area of Leeds, piles of rubbish by the side of the path. What a surprise, what a surprise. So that's it, back at Leeds station and on the train, or soon to be on the train, back to Huddersfield, and a short cycle up the hill, over the motorway and down back to home. So my first day of cycling the National Cycle Network of Yorkshire is done. Lots more to come in the next 4, 5, 6 months. Started off at the Tour de France, briefly visited Egypt, went round the world with Tim Moss, and then along the Greenway to Bradford and the canal to Leeds. So to finish off, we've come to Changchun in China. Just listen to that street atmosphere with traffic, trolleybuses and, of course, bicycles. Thank you for listening to episode 5. I'll be back with episode 6 of the Cycling Europe podcast very soon.